Well, good afternoon, and it's Juno afternoon. Pat Moore, your host. We'll listen today to an interview between Katie Bousler and Frank Sullivan, whose band Dirty Kitchen is playing tomorrow night at the Gold Town. And Ken Fix will drop by to tell us about tonight's planetarium presentation on Neptune. We'll also hear from the Thunder Mountain High School drama students about their new production of Much Ado About Will, which opens this Friday. Weather forecast calls for rain, snow level about 1,000 feet, highs around 38, southeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. The snow level's dropping this evening down to around 400 feet with lows around 33 and southeast winds 10 miles per hour.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs became the ninth federally recognized tribe to open their own telecommunications company in Indian Country last week. Friday's ribbon-cutting ceremony featured speeches from dignitaries who came to recognize those who made the project possible. KWSO's William Robbins has more.
The new telecommunications company has a state-of-the-art fiber and fixed wireless network and will eventually serve everyone on the reservation with telephone and broadband services. And with its federal-eligible telecommunications carrier certification, the company will also offer eligible tribal members telephone services for $1 a month. Funding for the $5.6 million project came from federal agencies under the goals of stimulus money released by the Obama administration. Speaking at Friday's grand opening was the USDA Undersecretary for Rural Development, Dallas Tonsiger, who praised Warm Springs tribal leaders for their efforts in seeing the project through.
Your leaders have made choices with you about moving forward to make a better livelihood for the people around you. When you do that, and when you succeed at that, hundreds of other places around the country start to think maybe they can make those choices too, and people in those communities believe that they can achieve things.
With unemployment numbers at an all-time high, tribal leaders say the creation of this company is an economic development engine that will create jobs employing tribal members. In Warm Springs, Oregon, I'm William Robbins.
Federal officials are asking for patience as arguments continue over the construction of a Native American casino in northeast Oklahoma. KGOU's Kurt Gortney reports.
Assistant U.S. Interior Secretary for Indian Affairs Larry Echohawk told the Tulsa World the federal agency may have a, quote, future decision point on whether the Kylee tribal town can have a casino near Tulsa, Oklahoma. Echohawk asked for people to have patience and let the process move forward. While the secretary would not directly address the Kylee casino plan, he did say its gambling eligibility is currently before the National Indian Gaming Commission. Echohawk said the BIA's involvement in the case depends on what the Gaming Commission decides. Members of Oklahoma's congressional delegation have publicly opposed the casino. The Tulsa World newspaper reports a Washington, D.C. attorney for the tribal town said no further approval is needed for the Kylee's to build the casino. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gortney.
Clinics in at least one South Dakota reservation are working to reduce abnormally high infant mortality rates. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt has more.
High infant mortality rates have long been an issue in Indian Country. A task force chaired by South Dakota First Lady Linda Dugard recently revealed the state has an infant mortality rate of 7 per 1,000 births. That's the highest number in the region. Among Natives, the rate is twice that of the rest of South Dakota. Mission Medical Clinic Physician's Assistant Angela Chambers says she knows it's hard for many women to get to their facility, but there are steps every pregnant woman can take for themselves and their unborn children.
Taking advantage of prenatal and postnatal care is a challenge for many patients who don't have travel. They live on a fixed income, and so unfortunately, we may not be able to see them for their visits and catch some of those things that would be preventable. Every baby is different, every pregnancy is different, and you know our goal is to make sure that mom and baby are both healthy.
Chambers says the clinic hosts parenting classes to help expectant mothers learn how to better take care of themselves and their children. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
During this week in 1917, the reservation for the Tohono O'odham people was established. Today, the tribe's four land bases are comparable in size to the state of Connecticut. This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
National Native News is made possible with support from Days Inn of Anchorage. Wake up with the sun on the web at daysinalaska.com. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC, CLIC, GIVE when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO FM. You are listening to Juno Afternoon, Pat Moore, your host. And my first portion of the program today is actually a pre-recorded section of former Juneau resident and bluegrass artist mandolin player Frank Sullivan is back in Juneau with his Dirty Kitchen Band. That's Mike Munford on the banjo, Danny Booth on stand-up bass, Chris Laquette on guitar, and, of course, Frank Sullivan. They visited with Katie B. on the Monday Tideline show this week, just after their smash appearances, guest artists at the Anchorage Folk Fest. So here is that interview.
I'm not an audience of one. I know you're all listening.
Thank you, audience, for your applause.
Oh, my gosh. This is just so much fun to have you all here.
Oh.
So you've been at the Folk Festival in Anchorage.
Yep.
And, well, you know, when you're from Juneau, you think that you have, like, the only folk festival.
Oh, it's a great folk festival.
We call it the Alaska Folk Festival.
Yeah, well, it is the Alaska Folk Festival after all.
Right. But I'm curious about this Anchorage thing. You know, I mean, it sounds like it's enthusiastic crowds and workshops and the whole nine yards.
Yeah, we played on Friday night. We played a couple of dances, too, but we played on Friday night, and it was at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium, and there was over 1,000 people there. All the seats were filled, and there was people standing on the sides, and completely into what we were doing. It was really, really cool. You know,
that sounds incredible.
Yeah, it was great for people to, you know, yeah, finally have something to do. You know, it's been cold and snowy.
Had you ever had an experience like that, Danny and Frank, and being Alaskans in Alaska?
Not at the Alaska Anchorage Folk Festival. Both me and Frank had been to that a lot. Actually, I went to it a lot growing up, but never an experience where it was that full and that just exciting.
So that must have been quite a moment for y'all.
Yeah, it was great. I mean,
we
play for, you know, large festivals all over the country, and it's really great to be, you know, for me, and I'm sure Danny, too, to come home and play as the guest artist in a, you know, like hometown style, you know, and have everybody out and really supporting what you've been doing and working hard at, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I haven't played up here since 2002. You know,
it's been quite a while.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Oh, gosh.
Almost 10 years.
Now, did you do some workshops as well?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Danny did a quote-unquote bass wampin workshop. That's what it said.
He's
in the
got a stand-up bass right here.
I think it said wampin.
A wampin?
Yeah, it said bass wampin.
Yeah, I don't really know what that is, but I did it.
He womped all over that thing.
But we walked in and you were dismantling the bass.
Yeah, we don't know what was happening.
Yeah.
So demonstrated.
Did you have some enthusiastic students?
I had a lot of students, actually. There was 20, 25 people in there, and they were mesmerized by my disassembling of the instrument.
Yeah, this is a travel bass, so that it looks like a regular bass, but the neck joint is, you know, it kind of folds, and the neck folds back inside of it. It's a Charlie Chadwick folding bass. He's a buddy of ours. And anyway, yeah, it's a really great piece of engineering for sure to be able to travel with a, you know, a regular
upright bass. So it just folds up
bass
into a suitcase?
Well, it's a big flight case, but it's the size of the body.
It's pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
Usually don't pay any extra charges for it, and just pull it behind me wherever I go, and it's real easy.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. Who knew?
And Chris had a guitar workshop, and I was in the back trying to heckle him a little bit. And right before his workshop, I had a mandolin workshop. And seemed like there was some folks out that really had some great questions. And, you know, people were really into what we were doing. And, you know, it's really inspiring for me to be able to, instead of going somewhere and say, hey, man, what kind of strings do you use? You know, you go to a workshop. Hey, man, what kind of pick do you use? I mean, you know, some of those questions are fine and dandy, but it's really neat to go, like, well, how do you, you know, whatever.
Well,
you know,
that's
they
just,
really
the, you took
the
words right out of my mouth because, you know, I'm obviously a great appreciator of music because I play music on the radio.
Well, and you have us in here, too,
yeah,
so that's great.
But,
thank
but
you.
But really, I mean, you know, how do you get to that level, to that, you know, the, from plateau to plateau, and when you just, it's like, you know, like, so to speak, the back of your hand.
Yeah.
It must take a lot of practice and patience, I think, at some point.
Well, I think of it as a language, really, because once you know how to, you know the basics of it, you know, you start thinking that way, you know, and you maybe even dream that way after a while, you know. I think it just comes with time and practice and
so it just becomes part of your
yourself,
sort of
you
your
know.
Brain matter.
Yeah, you just get,
yeah.
And you get your muscle memory going and you get
that's
this
what I
pad
mean.
Of knowledge, you know, that you can rely on, you know, as opposed to just, you know, guessing at it all the time. You know, if you put in the time and study, you can actually, you know, play something, you know, meaningful as opposed to just playing it. You're actually making music, you know. So
it really, I think, really starts from listening and loving music, you know. If you don't love the music, you're not going to get very far with it. So if you love it, then
that's the start.
That's a great foundation to bounce off of.
Yes, indeed. Well, shall we play another tune here, fellas?
I think so.
Let's get Danny to sing one here. Which one do you want to do, Danny?
Let's do...
You know, you're back home again.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Let's do home again.
All right. There's a... We like to introduce songs kind of literally, you know. We actually played with a guy in, back east, and he introduced a song one time I thought was super funny. He says, yeah, let's do a song. You know, he was talking to the audience. Well, we're going to do a song now. It's about love that has faded. It's called Faded Love. And I thought that was pretty interesting. So this is a song about wanting to go back home again.
It's called I Want to Go Back Home Again.
That's it.
Who knew?
Genius. Pure genius.
You ready?
Yeah.
One, two, three, and...
I want to go back home again. See Mom and Dad and be with my old friends. I want to walk down that old dirt road. Ease my mind of a heavy load. I've been away too long. Don't fit in, but maybe I am playing in a game that I can't win. I want to go back home again, see Mom and Dad and be with my old friends. I want to walk down that old dirt road, ease my mind of a heavy load. I've been away too long. Not the reason that I saved. I chased a dream on borrowed time and it took me far away. But now my life is changing, all my dreams are falling through. But holding to this memory's about all I can do. I wanna go back home again. See Mom and Dad and be with my old friends. I want to walk down that old dirt road. Ease the mind of a heavy load. I've been away too long. again. See Mom and Dad and be with my old friends. I want to walk down that old dirt road. Ease my mind of a heavy load. I've been away too long. I've been away too long. I've been away too long.
Well, you said it. Definitely been away from here too long. God, that was just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah,
thank you.
Good job, man.
Thank
good
you.
Job.
Well, now, is this an album yet?
No, we just started working that song back in. Actually, in a band I was playing with when I lived up in Anchorage with Danny's dad, Greg Booth, we played that song. The band was Rank Strangers, and we're doing a few of those songs that Danny has learned
mm-hmm.
from that band.
So these are songs you probably like, kind of like heard in your sleep.
Exactly, very formative stuff.
It's really interesting.
Grew up listening to it.
Gosh. You guys, this is so great to have you here.
Well, thank you so much.
We're having kind of our own little private concert here on Monday Tideline with KDB because Frank Sullivan and the Dirty Kitchen Band will be at the Nickelodeon on Wednesday night, the 1st of February, starting at 7:30. It is sold out, but just for the record, at 6 o'clock, there's a jewelry show and meet and greet with Leah Sturgis.
Yeah, that's my
Frank's
wife,
lovely
Leah.
Wife.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of on an Alaskan and Northwest tour.
Just Alaska this time.
Oh,
I mean, that's
okay.
As Northwest as we can get, though, I guess. So, yeah, we Fairbanks and then Anchorage here in Juneau, and then we're going to Kodiak, playing in Kodiak Friday and Saturday. And then everybody goes their own separate ways, and I'm going to come back with Leah back to Juneau for a few days and visit with my niece, Maria, and Leah's mom and a few others, and hang out here for a few days, and then head back east.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you are headed down to Wintergrass, right?
We are playing at Wintergrass next month in February. Yep.
Okay.
I think it's the last weekend of February.
All right. And that's down in Bellevue, Washington.
Bellevue, Washington. Yes, indeed.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I think that some people might be getting their tickets at this point. So. We'll
All right. Well, you know, there's a huge Alaska.
You know, Seattle's next door, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. There's a huge Alaskan contingent that goes down there. A lot of folks from Alaska go.
Yeah, the Great Alaska Bluegrass Band. My next-door neighbor, as a matter of fact, yes.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and some friends from Kodiak, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. A lot of folks go down there. Yeah.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left of the program. Is there anything else that you guys want to talk about or music you want to share?
Well, yeah. Why don't we pick another one that Mike wrote? What do you think, Mike? Want to do the line drive? Or?
Sure.
Kind of stretch this one out a little bit for the folks to listen to. This is a fun one. He could tell you a story about it when he gets tuned up, but we recorded this on our last project that we put out, I want to say last year, but now it's 2010. But yeah, it's a really great piece that he wrote. I'm going to let him tell you about it, though.
Okay.
Well, since it is really baseball
okay,
season,
Mike.
And this is really a baseball town.
Oh, yeah, and a softball town.
This actually did originate to some extent in Camden Yards back in Baltimore with those hapless Orioles. They're having a kind of tough little string here the last several years.
Go Mariners.
Yeah, they can just go.
I can't.
That's fine. Just let them go.
Okay. Well, guys.
This is kind of I decided to take in a ball game in the middle of the afternoon there and. You know, was in the mood to see some hitting and running, but saw quite a bit of that in the parking lot. Hardly any of it in the stadium. But anyway, by the time, especially when our guys are up to bat, that's for sure. You know, it was like 10-0 bottom of the first, you know. So I was losing interest in this game very quickly until one of our guys got a line drive single. Thought, all right, there it is. That's the title. Here's the tune. So here we go, batter up. And
ready?
That's right. Strike, foul ball. Strike. Thank you.
Whoa. Oh, my gosh. That was incredible.
Woo, up a sweat in this cold weather.
Yeah. Is your face melted yet?
Could you repeat that?
I thought, is your face melted yet?
Just about. Oh, man. Gosh.
My fingers are.
That was just fantastic, all of you.
Oh,
thank
KB,
you so
thank
much.
You so much for having us today.
Well, thank you to Frank Sullivan on mandolin, Mike Munford on banjo, Danny Booth on stand-up bass, and Chris Luquette. I still got it wrong. Luquette on
guitar.
All
right. People spell my name wrong all the time.
Anyway, it was just fantastic.
No.
They want to call you Sullivan, right?
They want to call me Sullivan and ask what part of Ireland I'm from, but actually it's Sullivan. Yeah.
Well, guys, it was just fantastic to have you here, and I know that the people who have tickets, the smart people in town...
Well, the quick people, at least.
Who got those tickets, you'll be at the Nickelodeon on Wednesday night starting at 7:30, and it was our absolute pleasure. I'm speaking for the listening audience as well as myself to have you here in the studio.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Check us out online if you get a chance, folks.
Okay, yeah. You just go to Dirty Kitchen Band, all one word.
Yep, DirtyKitchenBand.com. Make it real easy. Yeah. And we got a Facebook page and Twitter. And, if you still use MySpace, we got that too. So.
Okay. I'm sure people can find you. And your latest album is Dirty Kitchen from 2010.
Mm-hmm.
But you're working on another one. So.
Yep, getting stuff ready for that this summer, hopefully.
Yeah, just get on that website and get yourself on the mailing list.
There you go.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you. Woohoo!
It's 26 minutes after 3. You've been listening to a recorded interview with the Dirty Kitchen Band. The artist and mandolin player is Frank Sullivan, and then Mike Munford is the banjo, Danny Booth is the stand-up bass, and Chris Luquette's on guitar. They're playing at the Nickelodeon tomorrow night at 7:30. Tickets on sale around town, and interviewed by Katie B. on Monday Tideline this week. So we proceed on with Juno Afternoon. My next guest is one of our regulars. Ken Fix is here to tell us about a show which is coming up, is it tonight?
Thanks for having me, Pat.
Yes, tonight at the facility over there, the planetarium. And now we have passed through most of the solar system and you're out near the raw edge.
We're starting to get pretty far out there. So tonight's show is on Poseidon and Neptune.
And Poseidon, of course, is the god of the ocean.
Yes, ancient god of the seas.
The trident, yeah.
Trident. Yeah, the one with the trident, and he was second in power only to Zeus.
Uh-huh. So what's the relationship between, why is Neptune named for the ocean, or named for that particular god? What's that, how's that work?
Well, we hadn't really named another planet for over 100 years after the discovery of Uranus, which was in 1741. So this was over 100 years later when we had data on a full orbit of that planet and realized that something wasn't right with the orbit. Something was pulling on it at one point and retarding its speed at another point. And this is the discovery of a planet that had been worked out mathematically before anybody had actually observed it through a telescope.
So who did the math?
Le Verrier, who is a French astronomer, and the other guy was John Couch Adams, who was a British astronomer. Both of them came to the same conclusion mathematically at almost the same time, because we had to wait until we were sure of the data, and Uranus had reached that point in its orbit where it was getting yanked along and then held back a little bit. So we knew there was something out there pushing at it and pulling at it, and that's how they figured out that there was another planet out there, at least one.
And so this is an error or what appears to be an error in prediction, and that leads us to some section of the sky that we have to look at in order to see Neptune. Is that what the mathematicians predicted for us?
Correct, yes. Once they had gotten enough data on the orbit of Uranus, they knew that, hey, it should be over here at this time, and it wasn't quite there. So they knew that something had been yanking on it and then holding it back at another point.
Who made the first observations, do we know?
Well, there's actually records that show that Galileo had probably seen it back in the early 1600s, but didn't realize what he was looking at. Of course, the precession for Neptune is very slow. It takes 164 years to go around the sun. So looking at it from night to night, it almost has the same position in the sky. So Galileo probably mistook it for a star and didn't realize what he was looking at.
His observations were done pretty much with the naked eye, very low telescopic power.
Yes, he had the first telescope. He's credited with the first telescope, and yes, he wrote down several observations, and it's by going back through his notes that we figured out that he probably saw it but didn't know what he was looking at.
So then who's the first person who actually says, okay, it's where you guys said it would be?
Le Verrier was the one who had the French Astronomical Society actually take a look at where he predicted that the planet should be. And within about 1 degree of where he said it should be, they found it. So
when you say a degree, this is like a degree of the night sky. You think of a circle around
yourself.
Correct,
a 360-degree circumference, yes, okay. Within 1 degree of that. That's where they found it.
That's a high degree of accuracy.
That's pretty good. Yeah. You know, you're working everything out without a computer. Everything's done. I don't even know if they had slide rules back then, but somebody was working it out on paper and figuring out where this thing should be.
Any idea how big a scope it takes in order to be able to see Neptune from Earth?
Amateur astronomers can make it out, but they're going to have to get a fairly decent telescope. I mean, just something that's got 100 power or less is probably not going to be able to resolve that image. Neptune is very dim in the sky. It doesn't reflect a lot of light. It also has a bluish color because of the amount of methane in the atmosphere. So that kind of sucks in the red light and reflects blue light back.
And we know this composition of the atmosphere and these things from...
Well, direct observation and also the data that we got from Voyager 2 in 1989. That's the only space probe that has ever been to Neptune and probably the only one that will be for quite a while.
How close did it come?
Oh, within probably about 40 million miles or less.
Okay.
So it was at the time when we launched the Voyagers, and Voyager 2 was designed to take advantage of a rare planetary alignment, so that at the time it was getting out to these various orbits on a straight line, those planets were coming into view. So with very little fuel to correct its course, it was able to take what they call the grand tour, and the only planet that was missed was Pluto.
Hmm. At the time, it was a planet.
I'm still going to call it a planet. What the heck? We all learned that. That's the way I'm keeping it.
So. Yeah. Well, it messes up the mnemonics for memorizing the planet.
Yeah, it does. I don't know why they were so hesitant to retain it as a planet, because that, I think, is just confusing people and not very smart.
So Neptune has some unique characteristics. It's a fairly fast day, you were saying.
Yes, it's got one of the fastest rotations of planets in the solar system. It rotates on its axis every 16 hours. And it also has the highest wind speeds recorded of any planet, where the winds whip along at about 1,300 miles an hour.
This is beyond hurricane force.
probably five times worse than like Katrina is. Yeah.
So not a good place to build a house.
Not really, and really of very little interest to us out there. I mean, there's several other planets with moons that are of a lot more interest to astronomers. You know, when I covered Saturn, I covered a moon called Enceladus that actually has water geysers, saltwater geysers coming off of it. I mean, come on. That's water's one of the basic ingredients that we know of for life, and if there's going to be any chance of locating something in the solar system with any kind of life, even if it's microscopic life, it's going to be in a place where there's liquid water, and Enceladus has it, and not hardly anything else in the solar system does.
Does Neptune have moons?
Yes.
How many?
Has 13 as of last count. The largest is Triton, and it has more of a characteristic of a moon than what you would think of. The rest of them are pretty much rubble. I mean, there's 13 different moons, but they're not very regular shaped. They have no, round characteristics like a moon normally has. Some of them are like oblong, look like potatoes. I mean, for me, that really isn't a moon, but they categorize anything that can orbit another planetary body as being a moon. And it's really sort of like garbage out there, but 13 moons as of last count.
You were also telling me that Neptune gives off more heat than it should.
Yes, it takes in very little energy from the sun, but it gives off 2.7 times as much energy as what it takes in. So it has an internal heat source, and that's probably due to atmospheric compression. You know, if you've got a fast orbit and, you know, everything's kind of pulling in on itself like an ice skater with their arms pulled in. That sort of compresses the atmosphere, and it will generate heat at the core, and that's what Neptune is giving off, is that excess energy that it's building up in itself.
So what will you do in tonight's show? If I come, what will I see?
Well, I will talk about the ancient Greeks and how they perceived their origin to be, and I will cover two of the major myths about Poseidon, which also dovetail into Zeus's daughter Athena, because they're really interconnected. It's how they named the city of Athens in the first place, but Poseidon and Athena were both competing to see who would become the god or goddess of the city. And then also the tale of Medusa is intimately related to Athena as well as Poseidon.
Medusa and Poseidon? I guess my mythology is a little shaky here. How are they related?
Okay. Neptune or Poseidon had intimate relations with Medusa and her two sisters inside of one of Athena's temples. And Athena, as a virgin goddess, took this to be a great affront to her, and she knew she couldn't get punishment against her uncle, but she said, I want these three punished for what they've done. And Zeus said, okay, why don't we change them into Gorgons and give them snake bodies and snakes for hair and make them so hideous that nobody else will want them, and if humans look at them, they would turn to stone. And Athena said, yeah, I think I could live with that. And that's how that happened. A lot of people know that Perseus was then given the task of slaying Medusa, and actually went to Athena for advice, who was more than eager to help out somebody that wanted to do this, because she had an axe to grind against Medusa anyways. And that's how Athena lent Perseus a shield that was polished on the inside like a mirror, so that when Perseus got there, he could look at Medusa's reflection, not look at her directly, and sever the head of the Gorgon, which Athena actually wanted. So Perseus did that. He also had some aid from Hermes, who lent Perseus a pair of his winged sandals. So as he entered Medusa's temple, he wouldn't make a sound. His feet wouldn't touch the floor. And from that, we also got the myth of Pegasus, because as drops of blood hit the floor from Medusa's head, up sprang the winged horse Pegasus. And Perseus was able to use Pegasus to finish off his quest and destroy the Kraken with that. And also, he gave it back to Athena at the end of his quest, and she put it on her battle armor, and that's where it is to this day.
Ken, there's a movie in there somewhere.
Oh, yeah. It was called Clash of the Titans, and there was two different versions, but the one with Sam Worthington was actually really good, and it actually described this in the story, which I was amazed that they'd actually covered the fact that Poseidon had relations with Medusa, and Athena got mad and turned her into a Gorgon. And I'm amazed that they covered that in the movie, because in the old version back in the 80s, they didn't say a thing about it, and most people don't even know that part of the myth.
Wow. So you'll go into some of this tonight?
Definitely, yes.
And do you fire up the planetarium for these presentations as well?
We will be, because once we're starting to get to some of these further out planets, there's not a whole lot of visual data to present. So we've been covering the stars tonight at the beginning of the show, which takes about 15 minutes, and then I launch into the presentation specifically for Poseidon and Neptune.
Now, so February 20th, you've got a big deal coming to the planetarium, right?
Yes, we do. We have a guest speaker that we're actually paying to come here. His name is Dennis Mamana, and he is an astronomer, and he's also an expert in the Northern Lights. And his presentation on the 20th of February, it's a Monday night, will be at 6:30 p.m. at the planetarium, and we will actually be charging admission for that one, because we actually went through the expense of bringing him up here. So that one will be a $5 admission for individuals and $10 for families, for those that want to attend. I would highly encourage it. He's got very good photographs of the aurora. He's going to be on his way up to Fairbanks after he stops here in Juneau, and he's doing presentations on the aurora up there.
And, of course, tonight there's no charge for the show on Neptune.
No, tonight's show is free.
Right. And it starts at?
Starts at 6:30 p.m. and should be over at 7:30, and it's at the Marie Drake Planetarium, which is on Glacier Highway in the Marie Drake Middle School building.
Ken Fix, thank you very much for filling us in on the fabulous stories of the Greek gods and the great information about the planets.
Thanks for having me again, Pat.
Now, you betcha. See you later.
Bye.
is bird note. When winter turns the world white, some animals of the northern latitudes follow suit. Call it a seasonal change of camouflage. Best known is the ermine, a small weasel whose fur changes from brown to snow white in winter. A few birds also change color. One such is the willow ptarmigan, a chicken-sized bird of the northern tundra known for its giddy voice. The willow ptarmigan, feathered mostly brown in summer, is utterly transfigured by an autumn molt. As snow begins to mantle its world, the newly white-feathered ptarmigan blends in superbly. Where a covey of ptarmigans sit with feathers fluffed up against the cold, they resembled nothing so much as a row of oversized snowballs. Only a flick of their black tail feathers gives them away. The ptarmigan pulls yet another winter trick. It adds dense feathering, white of course, on both the tops and bottoms of its feet, and its claws grow longer. The winter ptarmigan actually quadruples the bearing surface of its feet, which is to say, the bird grows snowshoes. Well, it's no wonder why the ptarmigan likes a good laugh. Take a good look at the chameleon bird, the ptarmigan, on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Programming is sponsored by Frank Sullivan and Dirty Kitchen, performing original bluegrass and acoustic Connor Roots music at the Gold Town Nickelodeon February 1st, with the Leah Sturgis Jewelry Art Sale starting at 6 and concerts starting at 7:30. Info and tickets at dirtykitchenband.com and krnn.org.
Pat Moore, your host today at about 18 minutes before 4 o'clock on Juno afternoon. I have a practical army in the studio with me today, students from TMHS who are doing a play. Can you tell us a little bit about it? Kristen, step up to the mic and be the first to speak. My
Hi.
Guests are Kristen Garo, Veronica
Bunis,
thank you, Ailita Gallo, and Ryan Hicks. So, Kristen, now it's your turn.
Well, we have three members of the cast of our show. Our show is called Much Ado About Will, and it's a collection of scenes and monologues and pieces from a variety of Shakespeare's plays. And it's just kind of a greatest hits collection, celebrating all the different ideas and themes that come up in Shakespeare's work.
A greatest hit collection of Shakespeare. So give me a greatest hit, anybody.
The Balcony Siege for Romeo and Juliet.
Ah, okay.
I'm Juliet.
Ah, and so you're actually going to play the balcony scene? Who's playing Romeo?
My best friend Jasmine.
Ah.
We don't have enough guys to fill all the male
parts.
Enough
guys to fill a thing. Ryan, so are you double teaming?
I am one of four males in the cast.
So what are your roles? I think it's you're all in several times, right? Okay. Are you changing costumes like 30, 40, 50 times?
Mattering on the person. Like some of us don't have any and some of us have like five.
Yeah.
I have five costumes. Cool. One of the greatest works is Midsummer Night's Dream, The Rustics, Part 2. Yeah. I am Flute, who plays Thisbe, the woman. And I have a bunch of costume parts. I have a beautiful blonde wig, a blue skirt, a scarf, and a coconut bra. So I look very womanly.
So what other roles are you playing, Ryan?
I'm also playing York, who is trying to condemn and burn Joan of Arc. Mm-hmm. And I'll be playing Henry V, who is telling his soldiers to go into war.
So do you have any somebody I once heard in the middle of an interview said that it was a problem when they were playing Shakespeare because most of it's in iambic pentameter. It was real easy to slide from one play into another, and when that happened, the actors had to figure out how to get back into the play they were supposed to be doing. Do any of you have confusion about your line? Dead silence. No one is confused about their lines. We've solved that problem. Okay.
Well, I think like sometimes it can be hard, like trying to stick with like the rhythm that the words are in or trying to figure out how to memorize our lines. We had a few guests come in to help us with our show, and like the biggest thing that one of them would say is like we all had memorized like how it was written and not how it should be said. So we take pauses at the period, and then he's like, no, you don't need to take a pause there. It's just there for easy reading. Don't take a pause there. That's not natural for an actor to do. So I think there has been like a lot of people who've had trouble with that going on in the show. I definitely have myself. So.
Mm-hmm. How big is the cast?
We have a cast of about 19 students. And plus, those are actors in the show. Plus, we have about 7 or 8 students who are working on the crew. We have students who are doing all the lighting design and students who are doing sound design. And then all of our backstage crew as well, our students. So it's almost 30 kids involved in some way or another. So
with all of the changes and everything, this is a pretty active piece, I take it. It's almost an athletic event, it should be, with the getting on and off stage. Veronica, how many times are you in and out?
I'm in and out several times. There's usually almost always a bunch of us on the bleachers watching what's going on in the scene as well.
So is this set as a play within a play kind of thing? Or is this a high school drama class that's doing the high school drama class?
Yeah,
you said bleachers.
Kind of. Our set is a very basic set that has just a black backdrop with like regular bleachers just sitting on the stage. And then everything else, like any I don't think we have any beds, but like we have like lounge chairs and stuff. We have a few of those actual things, but most of the chairs or tables are... We just have these black cubes that represent them, and then the actors bring on and off props that they use for their specific scenes. But a lot of the actors, especially in the first act, are there almost as audience members watching their fellow actors perform their scenes. So it's like a group of actors coming together, and then you're playing an actor who's playing a character.
Did you find anything in Shakespeare that surprised you?
There are lots of jokes that you don't always get the first time around reading it.
Yes.
Anybody got it, for instance? Maybe I put them on the spot here. Okay. Anyway, Shakespeare did this wonderful bi-level thing because there were always actors out in front, even in the deep dramas where you have, you know, a murder as the center of the play. There's a couple of comic characters who are yucking it up. They're the door guards or mm-hmm. someone like that. Are you doing pieces from both levels?
We have quite a few comedic pieces because they, you know, are more audience pleasing until a lot of the times. But we do have scenes from the Scottish play, and we have we have an whole entire section devoted to kings that he wrote about. And like Ryan said, he's playing one of the Henry V. His monologue is very like one of those like inspiring monologues the kings give. And there's another scene that I don't know it, but like one guy has killed a woman's husband and he's in love with her. So like there are the dark sides to things, but there's also a lot of comedies. We have like 3 scenes from Midsummer Night's Dream.
Me in a coconut bra. That's pretty comedic.
So was this a class that you all took, or is this across the board from all areas of TMHS?
We had auditions for a different show, and that show ended up getting canceled, and so now we're doing this one instead.
So,
but it's all the same cast.
How
like,
do you feel
auditioned.
About that?
Stressed. It was very stressful, but now that we're actually like about to do this one, it's a lot of fun.
I wasn't in the original cast. I showed up to talk poster for A Taming of the Shrew, and they decided that they wanted me to be in the show.
Yes, Veronica is our poster designer.
Yes, I do the posters for all the Thunder Mountain High School plays.
And Kristen, your role here is?
My role is producer and director of this production.
And probably with the size of your cast and crew, zookeeper as well.
A little bit of zookeeper, yes.
Did they give you a chair and a whip to go on? Well, times and details. When does the show, when do we get to see this thing?
Well, you can see the show. It opens on Friday this week. Mm-hmm. So Friday night, Saturday night at 7:30 out at Thunder Mountain. And it special Super Bowl matinee at 2 o'clock on Sunday. So if you'd rather be doing something else than watching the Super Bowl, you could come watch the show. And then at 2 o'clock. And then the next weekend, we also have shows on Thursday night, Friday night, and Saturday night at 7:30. And we're also offering a special package deal. If you want to buy some tickets online through the JAC, JAHC.org, you can purchase a ticket to our show and a ticket to Kiss Me Kate, the JDHS musical, and get $2 off of your ticket price. So if you're thinking about going to both shows, go online and purchase your tickets.
Okay, so the first possibility here is Friday night at 7:30. Okay,
yeah.
And that's a full costume. That's not like a rehearsal or something like that. No, this is the you're on the boards. Okay, and then Saturday night 7:30, and then a Sunday 2 o'clock matinee, and then the following weekend Thursday, Friday, and Saturday 7:30. What's the cost?
It's $8 for students and $10 for adults. And you can get tickets at all the usual places. At Hearthside Books, at the door, or online.
But to get the special deal, you have to actually go over to the JAC or go to their website.
You can go online to their website.
Yeah, to go to their website. And it's a $2 off deal for tickets both to the TMHS play and to Kiss Me Kate, which is being put on by Juno Douglas High School. Wow. Okay, so a final quote from Shakespeare from somebody for getting us off into Writer's Almanac.
I can do one.
Yes.
Doubt that the stars are fire. Doubt the sun doth move. Doubt trust to be a liar, but never doubt I love.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 31st of January, 2012. It's the birthday of the man who holds the European record for reciting from memory Pi, Daniel Paul Tammet, who was able to recite pi, the number that begins 3.14, all the way to 22,514 digits, which he did from memory in 5 hours and 9 minutes. He was born in London, 1979, grew up autistic, epileptic, and with synesthesia, a rare condition in which a person has unique sensory experiences, which Tammet himself described as a visual emotional experience of numbers, a neurological mixing of the senses in which he saw alphabetical letters or numbers in color. Vladimir Nabokov, the writer, was also a synesthete and documented this in his memoir, Speak Memory. Daniel Paul Tammet begins his memoir, "I was born on January 31st, 1979, a Wednesday. I know it was a Wednesday because the date is blue in my mind, and Wednesdays are always blue, like the number 9 or the sound of loud voices arguing." He wrote, "Numbers are my friends, and they are always around me. Each one is unique and has its own personality." The memoir entitled Born on a Blue Day, Inside the Extraordinary Mind of an Autistic Savant. It's the birthday of John O'Hara, born in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, 1905, one of the most popular serious writers of his lifetime. Wrote many best-selling novels, Appointment in Samara, A Rage to Live. Many critics consider his best work to have been his short stories, collected in 1984. It's the birthday of Norman Mailer, born Long Branch, New Jersey, 1923, an engineering student at Harvard when he was drafted into the Army, 1944. Served in the Philippines, Japan, then after the war moved to New York City and spent about a year writing a novel about the war called The Naked and the Dead. Considered the definitive literary novel about World War II, and it made Norman Mailer famous at the age of 25. Won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Armies of the Night, and again for his nonfiction novel, The Executioner's Song, in 1979. Here's a poem for today by Linda Gregg, entitled The Wait. Two horses were put together in the same paddock, night and day, in the night and in the day, wet from heat and the chill of the wind on it. Muzzle to water, snorting, head swinging, and the taste of bay in the shadowed air, the dignity of being. They slept that way, knowing each other always. Withers quivering for a moment, fetlock, and the proud rise at the base of the tail, width of back, the volume of them, and each other's weight. Fences were nothing compared to that. People were nothing. They slept standing, their throats curved against the other's rump. They breathed against each other, whinnied and stomped. There are things they did that I do not know. The privacy of them had a river in it, had our universe in it, and the way its border looks back at us with its light. This was finally their freedom, the freedom an oak tree knows, that is built at night by stars. A poem, The Weight, by Linda Gregg, from Chosen by the Lion, published by Grey Wolf Press and used by permission here in the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses use email marketing with social media to reach more customers in more places. Online at constantcontact.com. Produced by our technical director, Thomas Schweitzker. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Tell my mama, tell my papa too, tell the neighbor boy and the friend I knew in school. I'm leaving Dixon. Across that South Coast County line.
The CBJ Street Maintenance Division regularly conducts snow removal on Juneau streets, and streets that are going to be cleared will be marked with yellow no parking signs. If these show up, please remove your vehicle from those streets and avoid driving down them while snow removal operations are underway. It's very dangerous for vehicles to try to pass snow removal equipment, so be careful. The signs on the back saying keep back 50 feet mean it. Any vehicles left in the street will be ticketed and towed to the Yacht Club parking lot. So please visit juneau.org/streets for the streets that will be affected by snow removal starting January 31st tonight at 7 p.m. And if you're curious, keep on the site between then and February 3rd, 2012 to find out where you should not park your car or where you need to watch out for snow removal equipment while it's going through. Related to that, you can also adopt a fire hydrant. One of the big problems that the fire department has is that fire hydrants need to be cleared. It'll take more time than the trucks have available in water to shovel the snow, and a fire could double in size several times in that length of time. So if you or a volunteer group or your neighborhood would like to adopt a fire hydrant and keep it clear of snow, that's what the Juneau Fire Department is asking you to do. Amanda Compton will host Juneau Afternoon tomorrow. She'll have a guest to talk about AARP's free tax preparation service. Kenny Chapman from NAMI Juneau will be with her to tell us about upcoming family-to-family classes. Jennifer New and Lorenzo Caponati, an olive oil farmer, will talk about olive oil tastings. And we'll learn about this week at Eagle Crest when Amanda Compton hosts Juneau Afternoon tomorrow. This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we also broadcast on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can tune to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens to us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Straits, you can hear K2 on K210 AS at 89.9. In Juneau, you can receive KTOO on GCI Cable. We're on digital channel 871. Our sister stations, KRNN, are on 872 and KXLL on 873. And we're also online at www.ktoo.org.
Wide new world, the wide new world. Such a big open space for our restless little girl. I don't know. I'll be coming back again from the wide blue world, the wide blue world.
be coming back.